The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
I'll tell you a quick story. You make decisions, and sometimes you make decisions and you know exactly what the decision is. You're completely shalem, you're at peace with what the decision was. People agree with you, they disagree with you, you know you made the right decision. And sometimes you make decisions and you realize you made the wrong decisions, but, you know, there are those who suggest there's no such thing as a wrong decision and a right decision, they're just decisions. You know, you have to make decisions. But sometimes you make decisions and you really struggle with them. Because it's very hard to objectively know whether you've made the right decision. This was one of those cases, right? And in fact, I got so into preparing this class and thinking about it that I wrote this up as this week's Parsha Byte. So if you want to review it over Shabbos, you can get it on email. But this was maybe 6 months that I was in this particular army unit. And one of the guys came to me. He was very upset because I think it was somebody had stolen his toothpaste. A soldier came to me and said he was upset somebody stole his toothpaste. You know, you're an officer. We'd actually just come down from Lebanon. There are like serious issues you're struggling with. We had to get a whole bunch of tanks up online and somebody stole your toothpaste. And you have to also understand that in the army, as terrible as this may sound, stealing is like a way of life. In fact, of all the mitzvot that I found difficult to sort of fulfill while I was in the army, you know, some things are easy. You know, a kashrut. Keeping kosher in the army, in the Israeli army, is very easy, because everything's kosher pretty much, right? Shabbat, you know, except when you're on patrol, and then you have to just learn the right halachot and know what to do and what not to do. But some mitzvot are very difficult. Waking up early in the morning to pray, to daven, that was very hard, you know, when you had very little sleep. But of all the mitzvot, the most challenging was theft. Okay? Theft is a way of life. And everybody steals. And I'm not talking, you know, it gets to the point where it's not really stealing. You know, you show up for, I don't know, even in the reserves, in Miluim, you show up for reserves, for, you know, Miluim, and the first day you have to go to the, you know, the Fsanaot, the commissary, I don't know what the English word is. And not the mess hall, the supply room, I don't know what it is. And you're signing up, I don't know, you have a unit of 30 guys, so everybody has to get on the first day, you have to get his canteens and his webbing, ephod, and his army coat or whatever. And there's a guy who works in this supply depot or whatever, and he brings you 30 coats, and then he brings you whatever, and you're supposed, and he makes a big list of, 30 kit bags. So you know that he brings you 30 coats. You know that one of your guys, at some point over the next month, when you're wherever you're doing patrols, is going to lose a coat. That's just the way it happens. And you're going to get to the end, and he's not going to have the coat to give you back. And you're signed on all these coats. So the guy goes to the back of the thing, right? And you're like, you know, he's not looking. You grab a couple extra coats, you put them in the pile. And you say to yourself, you know, you're not really stealing, right? Because you're not taking the coat for yourself. If nobody loses a coat, right? So then you'll have 32 coats to give back, and you'll give them right back, and you'll say, well, we found a couple of extra, right? And if somebody does lose a coat, then he's technically supposed to tell you that he lost a coat. And it's his problem, and if he doesn't, so he's stealing. So you have great ways to rationalize it. But at the end of the day, I mean, you know, it's stealing. You're stealing, right? And when you're in basic training, you know, you have a mizdar in the morning. You wake up and everybody has to go on inspection. And somebody left his canteen by the water faucet. And somebody else's canteen is on the bench. And all of a sudden you realize you don't have a canteen, but there's a canteen in the middle of the tent. So you grab the canteen. Now somebody else is missing a canteen, but he sees somebody else's canteen, and he grabs the canteen. And eventually that original canteen finds its way, and somebody will say, does anybody have a canteen? And everybody will get their canteen. So it's not really stealing, right? Because we're all just, but stealing. I mean, you're stealing, right? Now there's certain types of theft that you never do. You don't take what's called tselem. You don't take very valuable items that are numbered, you know, a rifle, grenades are numbered, binoculars, you know, you take something like that from somebody, right? And a person can get court-martialed for that. And you never take gear from your buddy. You never go into your buddy's stuff and take his gear. Right? So on the one hand, I'm thinking like somebody took your toothpaste. It's in the bathroom. We're all in the same unit. Somebody, On the other hand, if somebody's stealing, it's a serious thing. And I started to notice, you know, another guy mentioned to me that somebody in the Yimbatei, and it hit ahead when one day, one of the guys had a package that he got from his girlfriend, and she had sent him some bottle of cologne, and he was really angry. He was going around the unit because somebody took his cologne. Now, this is a big problem. It's not just a problem because cologne is disappearing. It's a big problem because if there's somebody in the unit, and it was very clear it had to be somebody from in the unit who's stealing, then you can't trust somebody. And once you can't trust somebody, and you don't know who that somebody is, you really can't trust anybody. And if you can't trust each other in an army unit, you got a big problem. Anyway, it took me about 3 weeks to catch this guy. I took a fresh bottle of Pierre Cardin, I had a new flashlight, I doused it in Pierre Cardin cologne, I left it out. Sure enough, this idiot took it. It was very easy to find the trail of Pierre Cardin cologne, and we caught the guy. And I was just shocked at who it was, because he was a really good guy, and he would always help in the unit, etc. So I took him aside, I take him out of the tent, you know, it's like 1 o'clock in the morning, and, you know, Makalacha, what's the matter with you? You're stealing. And he starts to rationalize it. Well, I'm not stealing, you know, it was there, and I was just going to use it, I was going to give it back. And the guys don't mind. And I realized that not only was he a thief, but it didn't bother him that he was a thief. So I'll spare you the whole story. I came to the conclusion, this guy had to be out of the unit. You know, if you have a guy who's willing to take from his buddies, I can't have a guy like that in the unit. Now, I was just a lieutenant. So this was a sipur, this was a story. So I had to go to the company commander, and eventually was, you know, some of the guys in the unit were upset. They didn't want to get this guy kicked out. And I said, either this guy goes, eventually I had to sit with the battalion commander. I had to tell him either he leaves the unit or I leave the unit. I can't command the unit if one of the guys is a thief. And I've caught him, and now everybody knows I want him out of the unit. And if he doesn't go out of the unit, you're undermining my blah, blah, blah. In the end, what they did was they switched him into another company in the same battalion so that they wouldn't have to do all the paperwork and it wouldn't appear on his record or whatever it was, their chashuv, but he was out of my unit. And there were a couple of guys for a long time who were really upset with me because he was a good guy and he was one of the best gunners in the brigade. Right decision or wrong decision? Interesting question. How do you know when you reach a point that you can't work it out? You know, some of you know me. That's my philosophy of life. We should always be able to work it out. You know, to have a neighbor you don't get along with, that's crazy. You know, so hug him every day. Take him apple pies every afternoon. You know, you can kill a person with kindness to such an point. If we refuse to live in a state of ill will, then you can't be in an argument, right? You can't argue with me if I refuse to argue with you. Eventually, you have to give in. But on the other hand, sometimes you really can't. Sometimes you just can't live with someone. I mean, if a guy moved in next door and he opens up a brothel and a crack house, so that would probably upset some of the neighbors, right? And you would say, listen, we refuse to live with this. And you would either decide to get them out, or you would probably move, or I don't know, you would move, you would hire the guards. But you wouldn't say, you know, we should all learn to live together. How do you know when you've reached that point? Sometimes it's easy. You know, if you have a brothel and a crack house next to that's an easy. But sometimes it's not so easy. Where's that line? How do you know when you've reached that line? You're talking about what to do about it. So I think maybe that's one of the questions in this week's parsha, this week's portion of the week. This is a very interesting story, and I want you to know, it's most of all so interesting because it's so surprising, it's unexpected the way that this unravels, okay? And most people are aware of this story, but just so we're all in the same loop, right? Really what we should have done is I should have forwarded a set of the pages, and you'd all have a text in front of you, but I didn't. So, okay. So, it says like this. I'm really reading in the middle of the story. We'll get back to the beginning. V'gam l'lot, ha'lechet Avram, and Lot, who, you know, was with Avraham, although that's a strange language, ha'lech et Avram. It should say ha'lech im Avram, right? He walks with Avram. So we already know that there's something a little off. Because he's with Avram, but he's opposite Avram. But okay. Hayat sonu v'kav v'alim. He also had flock, cattle, tents. In other words, Lot now has money of his own. Right? Lot comes with Avram and Sarah up to Canaan at the beginning of this week's portion. By the way, this week's parsha is, I guess you could call it the last in a series of beginnings. We've had a month of beginnings. Okay? We celebrated Simchat Torah, where we finished and then begun the Torah. And then we had Shabbat Breshit, where we read about the beginning of the world. And then we had Parashat Noach, where essentially the world ended and began again. And now we have Parshat Lech Lecha. The Jewish people are now beginning. And because this is the beginning, you know, it's like the story of the Battle of Britain. One of Winston Churchill's most famous lines, right? When it was very clear that the RAF had successfully conquered the skies, which absolutely changed the course of World War II and saved England and my mother, he said, this is not the end. This is not even the beginning of the end. But it is the end of the beginning, right? And I remember reading this line, I had no idea what that meant. I still have no idea what that means, but it's a great line, right? So this is the end of the beginning. And on a mystical level, because this parsha, because this portion is really the beginning of the journey of the Jewish people, with all the questions that that entails, why is Avram the first Jew and not Noach and so on and so forth, every story here is part of the character makeup, the blueprint of the Jewish people. And this story that we're going to read now is no exception. There's a reason that this story happens here. There's a lesson here that's critical for the Jewish people to begin their journey. So, Lot comes with Avram and Sarah up to Eretz Canaan from Haran, really, you know, from Mesopotamia. Then they come to Eretz Israel. There's a famine. There's no sustenance. They're forced to go down to Egypt. That's a whole other discussion. They're in Egypt. And that must have been a very difficult test to travel all the way to Israel. You know, everybody thinks you're wacko. I mean, you know, we don't think of this, but Avram is, you know, hearing voices, right? And God's telling him, you know, to go to Israel, and he goes. And Lot goes with him. And then they get there, and it's so miserable there, there's a famine. What about the reward? What about, I'm doing this for you, God, give me a break? No, so they go down to Egypt. They stay in Egypt, eventually for whatever the reasons, they leave Egypt, they come back, Lot comes with him. But now Lot's made a little money. Egypt was good for Lot. Okay? So, v'gam l'lot ha'olechet Avram ha'yatzonu v'akav o'alim. Lot also has money. Now listen to this. You want to hear a tragic verse? This is a tragic pasuk. V'lo nasa otam ha'aretz l'shevet yachdav, ki haya rechusham rav, v'lo yachlu l'shevet yachdav. And the land could not sustain them to dwell together because they had so much property. They had so much stuff. Now, understand the absurdity of this verse. Today in Israel, there are about 10 million people. You know, if we're looking at it apolitically, right? There are about, you know, including Yudah and Shomron and Aza and whatever. You're talking about 10 million people. And when you sit in America and you listen to CNN, you think like, you know, people talk about Jews making Aliyah, but there's no room for them in that tiny little country. But when you come to Israel, you take a trip up to the north or down south, Baruch Hashem, there's so much room, vistas as far as the eye can see, right? So there's lots of room, and that's today. So then, I mean, what lives in Israel today is more than the entire population of the world back then. There's no room, because they have stuff. You know, you get too much stuff, and stuff isn't, I think, an objective reality. It's not a function of a certain amount that you have. Some people have lots of stuff and there's always room. Some people have very little stuff, but there's never any room. So this is less about the stuff. It's more about Lot and Avram. And it's a little bit shocking. I mean, if you live with an Avram Avinu, with Abraham, how could you ever have a situation where there isn't enough room? I mean, that would be depressing. I mean, could you imagine you read an article that the Lubavitcher Rebbe and his next door neighbor were in some kind of a spat and there wasn't enough room for their cars to park? It wouldn't even matter whose fault it was. If you could read about the Lubavitcher Rebbe that he's in an argument over a parking space, it's ridiculous. There's not room for you. How could there not be enough room? And look at how the verse goes. V'lo nasau tamaretz l'shevet yechdav. The land could not sustain them to dwell together because their property was much. V'lo yachlu l'shevet yechdav. And they couldn't dwell together. In the first half of the verse it says, the land could not sustain them to dwell together. But in the second half of the verse it says, and they could not dwell together. In other words, the land may have been the catalyst, but it wasn't really the reason. They just couldn't live together. That's a very difficult pasuk. I want to understand that. I want to understand how, from my perspective of understanding who Avraham Avinu was, paragon of loving kindness, you know, source of recipe for hospitality. You know, he of the four-cornered, open to every direction tent, how he could be in a situation where there's no room, where they can't live together. I mean, could you imagine somebody saying that Mother Teresa couldn't live with him? I mean, that's ridiculous. So, okay, so now what happens? What do you do? And there's an argument between the shepherds of Avram and the shepherds of Lot. Okay, let's assume for the moment it has to do with grazing lands. There's not enough room to graze the flock, whatever. And the Canaanites then are living in the land. Now that's an interesting verse, because at least at first glance, it doesn't make sense what that's doing there. You know, the shepherds of Avram, the shepherds of Lot are having an argument, the land couldn't go, and the Canaanites are living in the land. I like peanut butter. Do you ski? What does that have to do with anything? So Rashi notices this, right? Rashi notices this, right? And, let's see, find the puzzle, right? Yeah, it's been that kind of day. So listen to this. Lefi she'ayu ro'av shelot resha'im. Okay? Rashi notices that the pasuk says, right, that the Canaanites were then in the land and that there was an argument. So what's the argument? Because the shepherds of Lot were evil. Umar'im behem tam bistot acherim. And they would graze their flocks in the fields of others. And the shepherds of Abraham, super tzaddiks that they were, they're telling them off. Because they're stealing. And they would say, well, listen, God promised the land to Abraham. Now, Abraham has no children. So Lot is his nephew. Lot's going to inherit the land. So if Lot's going to inherit the land, then this really isn't Canaanite land. It's our land. Eventually, it'll be our land. So what's the big deal? So it's not stealing. So that's why the pasuk says, the verse says, the Canaanites then live in the land. Avram had not yet merited this land. Let me tell you, on the one hand, this explains to me why the verse says and the Canaanites were in the land. Right? Because the Canaanites were in the land, it's not that, you know, on a contextual level, one would think that the Canaanites were in the land means that there's not enough room because the Canaanites were in the land. But Rashi says, that's not enough to explain to me why that's there. It's deeper than that. The Canaanites were in the land means the land still belongs to Canaan. To the Canaanim, to the Canaanites. And that was the essence of their argument. And the shepherds of Abraham are saying to the shepherds of Lot, how can you let your flocks graze on someone else's land? And they're saying, well, you know, eventually it'll be ours. Let me tell you what bothers me about this Rashi. Okay? This is so uncharacteristic of Rashi. Rashi, by the way, is probably the commentary on the Torah. Super commentary par excellence. When you get into studying, and you explore studying with text, and with commentaries, you have to start with Rashi. Rav Shlomo Yitzchaki, he lived from 1040 to 1105. He wrote a commentary on the entire five books of Moses, the prophets, the writings, the Nevi'im, the Ketuvim, the Gemara, and a number of other works that we have. And he did all this by the time he was 65. He died when he was 65 years old. Right? Lived in Provence and eventually in Virman. And Rashi states in his introduction to the Torah that he comes to explain pshat. He comes to explain the context of the verse, the basic understanding. You don't often find Rashi getting into a discussion like this. He said this, they said that. Well, you know, they were rationalizing. Just say, the shepherds of Lot were stealing. And the land belonged to the Canaanites, and that'd be it. Why this whole discussion? Okay. Now let me ask you a question. You have a nephew. He's your only nephew. He's your only blood relative besides your wife. You have no children. You're 75 years old, possibly 80. You're wealthy, but you have no one to give it to. You've discovered a new idea, but that idea is going to die unless you have someone to share it with. So this is your nephew. And for some reason, you can't get along with him. So what do? So you sit him down. And you say, let's talk. We can work this out, right? And there's nothing sadder than people who get into an argument and you sort of end up discussing with them what the issues are, and you realize that the problem is basically that they just can't talk to each other. Because they've gotten into the habit of not talking to each other. You have to be able to talk. So if there was ever a figure in the entire Torah that I would think would know how to do this, it would be Abraham. Now it starts out well. What does Avram do? Right? He sits Lot down and he says like this. Vayomer Avram Lot. When Avram says to Lot, okay? Al natehi meriva beini uveinecha. Let there not be an argument between you and I. Uvein roai uvein roecha. And between your shepherd, my shepherds and your shepherds. Now that's interesting, by the way, because the verse says there was an argument between the shepherds of Lot and the shepherds of Avram. It doesn't say there was an argument between Avram and Lot. But Avram comes to Lot and he says, let's not be in an argument. They were in an argument. Torah tells me that the shepherds were in an argument. So you could say, if my shepherds are arguing with your shepherds, pretty soon I'm going to be arguing with you. That's very interesting. How much we're affected. Think about it. If my children are arguing with your children, how long will it take before I'm arguing with you? Right? So we have a vested interest. You know? And there's a wider picture here. If my people are arguing with your people, you know, sometimes you meet people who don't understand what it means to belong to a collective. You know? If one Jew is arguing with one Arab, then we're all arguing with that Arab to some degree. Whether I agree with the Jew who's arguing with him or I disagree with him, that impacts me. Avram understands this. Let's assume that that's at least one possible way to look at this. It's also interesting to note, by the way, that it says, Vayehi Riv. There was an argument between the shepherds of Lot and the shepherds of Avram. But when Avram is repeating the issue, it says, Al natehi miriva. Let there not be a miriva. What's the difference between a riv and a miriva? It's kind of like on the night of Passover, right? On Pesach night. So, you know, everybody knows the manishtana, right? The four questions. So what do we say? Halayla zeh kulanu misubin, right? Lehasev is to lean, right? It's a symbol of freedom, okay? When you're leaning and relaxing, that's a party. That's freedom, you know? The act of leaning is lehasev. But the experience of leaning is a misiba. It's a party, okay? And we find this very often, right? Boged is a traitor. Bgida is the experience of traitorism. Traitorism? I don't know. Sounds like a good word. Whatever, right? Pardon? Mercy, right? Treason. Ah, there we go. Treason. There we go. See, I'm back in Israel. I can forget my English again, right? So if riv is an argument, meriva is a state of strife. In other words, Avram is saying, it's not just about this argument. You ever have an experience like that, you know? I have that with two of my kids. It's interesting. My older two children now, Baruch Hashem, they've graduated from those petty arguments, you know? They get along again. It's like shocking to Dorit and I, you know, how they get along. But the little ones, Baruch Hashem, they're carrying on the family tradition, you know? It's not just about an argument over a particular issue. Sometimes your kids just are in a state of argument. You're just waiting for the next spark, but they're in a state of argument. And sometimes never get serious. You meet people who are just there at war with each other. They don't talk to each other, they argue each other. The issue, that's just a symptom. So Avram isn't talking about the specific issue. He's talking about the fact that there's a state of strife here. We shouldn't be that. We shouldn't have that. Right? Ki anashim achim anachnu. Because we're brothers. Now that's beautiful. And if the story stopped here, I would be tremendously excited. Right? Because I would think that's tremendous. You know? That's what you have to do. Right? You have to sit down and express that we need to live together. But it doesn't stop there. Because now what happens is just unbelievable. And it's more unbelievable because it comes from Avram Avinu. Who would have expected that Abraham would produce this solution? Okay? Hi pared na me'alai. Separate yourself from me, please. You know, we're not getting along. So why don't you leave? Ima smol ve'imina, ima yamin ve'asmila. If you go left, I'll go right. And if you go right, I'll go left. Now imagine that you're in a big debate with, I don't know, Donald Trump about a couple buildings in New York City. Right? You know how Donald Trump looks at the New York City skyline, right? Got it. That, you know? So you're arguing with him over a couple buildings, right? So he says to you, all right, you know what? This is silly. I'll take this one, you take that one. So, you know, he's Donald Trump. He knows buildings. You think, oh, why does he say he'll take that one? Probably a better deal. And then you think, well, maybe he knows that I'm going to think that, so that's why he took the one that's worth. Like, you get into these mind games. So Avraham Avinu says, you know, whatever you want. You want this building, you want that building, you want both, whatever you want. I mean, this is Avraham. You go your way and I'll go mine. I mean, could you imagine, a couple comes, you know, I remember once, there was a couple that that I married, and I have a custom whenever I marry a couple, that I call them every year on their anniversary. You know, I got my little diary, whatever. You have a rav who marries you, which it shouldn't be just a ceremony. It's a responsibility. To... Anyway, so there was a particular couple, and a few years after they got married, and I called them up, and she answered the phone. And she started crying on the phone. I just called up to wish them a happy anniversary. Clearly there was something going on, right? Like if you're crying on your anniversary when the rabbi calls, something's wrong. Anyway, I ended up getting together the two of them. They were having some serious issues. And Baruch Hashem worked out. And they're happily married, right? And they come in and, you know, they're not talking to each other, right? And it was the funniest thing. He's telling me what she does. And I said to him, well, why don't you tell her? You know, she's sitting right there. He refuses to talk to her. And she's telling me, and she refuses to talk to him. So I figured out the solution to the problem. You know, you have to talk to each other, right? That's not so complicated, right? Imagine if I would have said to them right then, I said, you know what? You shouldn't be in a state of strife. Why don't you go to Los Angeles, and you go to Israel? And if you want to go to Israel, then you go to Los Angeles. Just split up. So they would have been like in shock, and they'd be right, because that's not the solution. Sometimes you have no choice, but that's not what you want. So how can Avraham say this to Lot? Listen, you know what? It's not going to work out. So let's just split up. This is silly. They invest effort in making peace. This is ridiculous. Let's just split up. We'll stop arguing with each other. Which is true, by the way. I mean, that is a way to produce peace in the world. If everybody bought an island and lived on their own island, there'd be no war. Because you'd never see anybody. The Jews would figure out how to make war. But everybody else wouldn't be able to do it. It'd be tremendous. So it's ridiculous. We're supposed to learn to live together. What does this mean? By the way, I'll tell you something really interesting, which is not objective fact. This is just a possibility. So, you know, if we learn together tonight, and you walk home and say, an interesting question, interesting idea, that's nice. But if I give you something to think about, and then maybe Shabbat, at the lunch table, you're thinking about this, then that's valuable, right? So I'll tell you something interesting. Let's assume, okay, well, you know what, I have to read the next verse, because look at what Lot's response is. It says, Vayisa Lot et inav, and Lot lifts up his eyes, Vayar et kol kikar hayarden, and he sees the rich valley of the Jordan River. To this day, that is one of the most fertile areas in the world. Okay, if you know the map of Israel a little bit, picture a map of Israel. Okay, hang on, we'll have some fun here. Okay, let's assume that this is a map of Israel, imaginary, coming down from this pelican? From the pelican's nose, okay, right? A flamingo, okay, right? So here's Lebanon, right? And you know this is Israel, and you've got the sea over here to the west, and you've got the Golan Heights and the Kinneret and the Dead Sea, and Yerushalayim is in the middle, and south of Yerushalayim is Beit Lechem and Hebron, and south of Hebron is Be'er Sheva, more or less, okay? And there's a mountain range. Okay, that runs up the center of the country, right? The Harei Hevron, right? To Yerushalayim, to the Shomron. And that's a very important mountain range. It has the aquifer, 30% of Israel's water is underneath that mountain range, right? And then there's a valley. And that valley has the Kinneret, the Sea of Galilee. It's a shtickl chutzpah that we call that a sea. But you know, whatever, we have big ideas, right? And the Jordan River that flows into the Dead Sea, Yam HaMelech, right? On the other side of that depression is you know, the Hare Moav, whatever, and the Hare Edom, right? And what you've got is a mountain range here, and a mountain range here, and the Jordan Valley in the middle. Right? With the Kinneret and the Dead Sea, Sodom, Amora, that whole area. Okay? And Lot lifts up his eyes and he looks out on the Kikar. Now, in order to be able to see the valley, you've got to be standing on the mountains. So they're standing on the mountains, and that makes a lot of sense, because Avram Avinu, according to Rashi, when he comes into the land of Israel, he comes from the east, right? Which is, you know, Mesopotamia, Iraq, you know, etc. And he heads towards Israel. According to tradition, the first place he goes to is actually Shechem. He goes to Har Gerizim and Har Eval, which is where one day the Jews will build an altar, and six tribes will stand on this mountain, and six tribes will stand on that mountain, right? And part of the reason that those 12 tribes go to this place first is that the first place Abraham went to when he came into the land of Israel is that same place, right? And that's north of Yerushalayim. And then he heads south. And he must pass through Yerushalayim because he's on the mountain range. And strategically, it makes sense to travel on the mountain range, even though physically it's much more exhausting, right? And he ends up in the area of Hebron and Beersheba. In fact, when he heads back for the binding of Isaac, and he brings him up to Har Moriah, he heads back north from Hebron and Beersheba. So he's somewhere up on the mountain range. Hebron, by the way, which is south of Jerusalem, is pretty much opposite the Dead Sea. So that makes sense. Okay? So what's interesting is, if they're standing on the mountain range, and they're looking west, eastwards, okay? And Avram says, if you go left, I'll go right. If you go right, I'll go left. So he's on the mountain range. He's basically saying to Lot, go this way or go this way. What does Lot do? He doesn't do either of them. He looks down in the valley and he goes straight ahead down to stone. And allegorically and maybe physically, Avram is telling Lot, if we can't live together in proximity, nonetheless, stay up here on the mountain range. Lot, however, goes down to the valley. Now, the valley symbolizes something very different from the mountain. Right? The mountain, where you're up high, it's not accidental that the holy places are all on high mountains. Hebron, Tzfat, Yerushalayim. Because when you're up on top of the mountain, things become more clear. You can see where you are. Represents being elevated. The valley is where you get stuck. Right? Vayisumi Kedem, after the flood. So, we don't know exactly where, but tradition has it somewhere in the mountains of Ararat, which is probably in Turkey, and it's probably in the northeastern corner of Turkey, which is above Iraq, right? So, the ark rests. And it's clear, it says, Vayisumi Kedem, and they travel from the east, and they're heading west. And they find a valley and they dwell there. And that's where the story of the Tower of Babel happens. Right? Tower of Babel, they mess up, and whatever the story there is. There's a sense that they want to go eastwards, westwards. And then Terach, at the end of the portion of Noah, is very interesting. The first to journey to the land of Canaan is not Avram. It's his father Terach. Only Terach doesn't get commanded to do it. He's just doing it. He takes his family, he takes Sarah, his daughter-in-law, he takes Lot, and they travel eastwards towards Canaan, westwards. But they also get stuck in Haran. And then finally, Avram continues the journey. There's a sense that they're supposed to be on a journey. There's a collective sense of humanity that we need to be in that place, for whatever the reason. We're looking for something, but they get stuck. So traveling westwards, that seems to be heading towards our purpose. That seems to be somehow an intuitive understanding of where we're supposed to be, land of Israel. Lot goes in the opposite direction. So literally, and of course figuratively, Lot is undoing. In fact, Rashi says, why does it say Vayisa Lot Mikedem and Lot travels from the east? It should say he travels from the west. Mikadmono shel olam. He's leaving the tent of Avraham. Now, by the way, this is the next fascinating thing. Let's put aside for the moment why Avram can't live with Lot. What does Lot do? So Lot We're almost done, and then we can start to see if we can put this together. So, Vayisa lo tetenav, that's a powerful phrase, Vayisa lo tetenav. Literally means he carries his eyes. You have a picture of a guy taking his eyeballs out. What it means is that Lot's eyes are leading him somewhere. We say in the Shema, V'lota tu achei necha, don't follow your eyes. You know? A guy could be sitting at a bus stop. Two fellows are sitting at a bus stop. And a beautiful girl walks by in a miniskirt. And one guy, he's studying Dafyomi, he's learning Torah. You know, so he happens to look up, but he doesn't really see the girl because he's learning Torah. And the other guy, right? So, you know, he's like, so he may be sitting in the bus stop, but he's not in the bus stop. Lot is up on top of the mountains, but he's really already in the valley. If you could live in the tent of Avraham and want to go to Sodom, you're not in the tent of Avraham. Maybe you were never in the tent of Avraham. And that's the second question. How could that be? How could you grow up in the tent of Avraham and want to go to Sodom? And that's what he does. He leaves, he goes to Sodom. The Torah takes pains to tell me that this is the most wicked place on earth. That's like a guy who grows up in the house of Lubavitcher Rebbe and then decides to leave in order to become the editor of Playboy magazine. That's nuts. Now, I'll tell you how it happened that a Lot ends up going to Sodom. That's actually not so complicated. Because there's a very interesting allusion. When Avram comes up to the land of Israel the first time, okay, it says, Vayikach Avram et Sarah ishto, he takes Sarah his wife, that Lot ben Achiv and his nephew Lot, v'et kol rechusham asher achashu, and all of their property. Sarah, Lot, and the property. They get to Israel, there's a famine, they go down to Egypt. They're there for a while, they come back up from Egypt. When they come back up from Egypt, right, the order is different. What does it say then? It says, Fayal Avram Mitzrayim, and Avram comes up from Egypt, who? The Ishto, and Sarah, the Kol Asher Lo, the Lot Imo. His wife, his property, and Lot. When they come up to Israel the first time, it's Sarah, Lot, and the property. When they come back up from Egypt, it's Sarah, the property, and Lot. The property is now in between Avram and Lot. On one level, that may mean that the fact that Lot has acquired all this property is now something that's come between him and Avram. On a deeper level, what's very clear is that something happens to Lot in Egypt. The Lot who comes back up from Egypt is not the same Lot who goes down. In fact, you could make a case for saying that although Lot physically comes back up from Egypt, a part of him is still in Egypt. In fact, I'll tell you how you know this, because when Lot looks out at the Valley of Sodom, it says that he sees, Vayivchal Lot, right, Vayarat Kol Kikar Yarden, he sees the lush Jordan Valley, Kikulam Mashkeh, right? Kegan Hashem, it's like the garden of God, Ke'eretz Mitzrayim, like the land of Egypt. Lot sees that as Egypt. Sometimes you meet, you know, Americans who so want to be in Israel, it's like they're almost in Israel. And sometimes you meet Israelis who so want to be in America, they may be living in Tel Aviv, but they're already in America. Where you are is also a function of where you want to be. Lot gets so immersed in the world of Egypt that a part of him can never come back to the tent of Avram. Fascinating to note, by the way, that Avram maybe understands this. Avram understands that Lot wants to be in Sodom. And if you want to be in Sodom, you got to let him go. This is probably one of the most painful pieces of our intuitive need to control our relationships. To be able to let go. To know that our children, that our spouses, sometimes our parents, friends, that they want to do something, they want to be somewhere, and we have to get out of the way, even though we know, or at least think we know, that where they want to be is the worst place for them to be. But sometimes they have to discover it on their own. Very painful. Which brings us back to our original question. I could understand if Avram would have said, come, we can work this out. And then Lot would have said, no, I want to go to Sdom. But that's not how it happens here. Abram says, look, we should split up. So Lot looks around and sees Sdom and goes to the most wicked place on earth, and whatever happens to Lot happens to Lot. Why does Abram suggest that we should leave? Now, I always thought that the reason that Abram suggests that we should leave is because he desperately wants Lot to say, no, 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 we can work it out. And that may well be true. But you know what? There was something that always bothered me about that. If you want somebody to do something, don't play these reverse psychology games. Like, that's okay when they're 9. But once you get to the world of adulthood, if you need something from someone, tell them. You know? It's like, it's this book. My wife once got me this book, right? Everybody knows this book. Men are from Mars, women are from Venus. If your wife gets you that book, you read it, right? So I read this book, and it was an epiphany for me. You know, I remember there's one that, you know, men love to live in their caves. You know, women want to fix things, right? When a woman, I remember reading this one paragraph, when a woman comes home at the end of the day, and she's sharing her day with her husband. She's telling her husband, you know, this happened and that happened, and the boss wanted this, and it wasn't so good. So what's the husband's natural tendency? You want to help fix it. Right? But the woman isn't asking you to fix it. The woman just wants you to hear about her day. Right? And so the man says, well, why don't you try doing this? The woman says, I'm not asking for your advice. I'm just telling you about my day. And the men sit there and we're like, what do we do? We're just trying to help. And the women are getting more and more annoyed. And I'm thinking, wow, this is my life. So I said, okay, I'm going to try this. So the next time Doree came home, right? And we're having this discussion. And she said, you know, there was a guy at the office and whatever and this and that. You know, and it was frustrating, or this and that, and I'm saying, by the way, is a very powerful word. I discovered the power of It's the greatest gift in parenting. No doubt about it. So we're having this discussion, you know, and Dorita's saying, and then this guy, and I'm trying to figure out this problem with this project, Anyway, this goes on for about a half an hour. And she says, you know, that was a great conversation. I'm like, you know. So we need sometimes, and I understand that. But if you want something from someone, be honest with them, tell them. You know, when you're 6 years old, you throw a temper tantrum, you go up to your room, and you really want your parents to come up and chase you. But you're not yet at the stage where you could say, I want to spend time with you. I want some attention. So you go and you get it. And how do you get attention? By leaving. But then you grow up and you realize that if you need attention, you sit someone down and say, listen, I need time from you. So why is Avram doing it this way if that's what Avram is really trying to do? So there is another possibility. The other possibility is very challenging. Because the other possibility is that Avram has reached the conclusion that he really can't live with Lot. That Lot has somehow crossed a line. And that because he's crossed that line, Avram, bearing the responsibility of the creation of a Jewish people and the creation of a moral, ethical society, to have one tent in the world that's a light unto the nations, to start somewhere, that because of that responsibility, because he understands that that's his mission, he can no longer let Lot be in the vicinity. And there are many instances of this in the Torah. The best example I can think of is when Yeshua enters the land of Israel. Yeshua comes into the land of Israel, wants to create a society based on ethics. The Gemara of the Talmud says he gives the Canaanite nations three choices. You can run. We're not interested in destroying the seven nations. If they leave, they run away, then fine. You can surrender. If you surrender, that means that you have to accept upon yourself the seven Noahide laws. You have to agree not to murder. I can't live next to a murderer. Or you can fight. The essence of this choice is predicated on the idea that if I have a murderer living next to me, if I have a thief living next to me, I'm not living an ethical life even if I think I am. You can't create an ethical home if a murderer lives next door. That seems to be what the Torah is telling me. Right? You can't build a synagogue next door to the Ku Klux Klan. It just doesn't work. Either they gotta go or you gotta go. And I'll tell you the best example I can think of this. This is an amazing example. It is absolutely one of the most difficult stories in the entire Tanakh. And this will bring us to the point. And then you'll see if you agree with what I think is really going on here, maybe. Samuel the prophet, Shmuel HaNavi. Shmuel HaNavi anoints the first king of Israel, Saul. And we don't really think about this because we have this image of the great king. But Shaul was a very young man. He was under 25 years old. He was the first king of Israel. He was tremendously humble. He was so humble, he couldn't imagine that it was him that they wanted to be king. He hides behind the wagon. Anyway, he becomes king. And at some point in his kingship, he is given what possibly may be the most difficult mitzvah a human being has ever been given. To destroy, without exception, the entire nation of Amalek. Amalek has come to represent pure evil in its raw form. The same nation that attacked the Jewish people from the rear, killing the women and children for absolutely no reason. Who did it after the sea had split, when it was clear that there was something going on, when the world was starting to take notice and take heed that maybe there was a new wave of morality, of ethics, of God coming into the world, comes along Amalek and puts an end to that. And according to some, Rav Soloveitchik suggests that any time a nation will rise up and try to destroy the Jewish people simply because we're Jewish for no apparent logical reason, that is Amalek in some form. And that's why Rav Soloveitchik believed that Nazi Germany was Amalek. Now imagine that you're given the mitzvah to destroy Nazi Germany. In 1941. In its entirety. So, I could intellectually understand, I have a hard time imagining that there's any adult between the ages of 15 and 60 who lived at that time who doesn't have blood on his hands in one shape or another. Whether he actively killed someone or just knew about it, I just have a hard time believing that. Personally. And I could even understand how the children who were being brought up in the Hitler Youth, that a society can reach a nadir of evil so extreme that it just, the world is better off with it being destroyed. And we know that that possibility exists because God destroys the world in a flood. But that doesn't mean we can make that decision on our own. But let's say you have God telling you that. So it's easy to understand how you could have such a mitzvah, but to actually do it, to kill off the children, to destroy all the livestock, to burn everything, very hard to do. So Saul does it. But he spares the last of them. The king, noble, with whom on some level perhaps Saul identifies because he's a king. To see a king, a royal noble, on his knees begging and crying for mercy. So Saul's mercy, he can't do it. So he spares Agag, the king. This will have disastrous implications because, you know, Agag will sleep with a concubine, she'll be pregnant, the seed of Agag will live on even after later Samuel kills him. The descendant of Agag is Haman, who's called the Agagi. The entire Jewish people are almost murdered because of this, but okay. Samuel comes along. He's supposed to destroy all the flocks, Saul, Shaul. But the people say, why should we destroy the flocks? This is terrible, they're just animals. That's one way of understanding it. So they decide not to destroy the flocks, but to offer up the best of them as a sacrifice to God. But that's not what God said. So Shmuel comes along. And Shaul says, I did the mitzvah. I did everything you asked. And I took the king Agag, and we've taken him captive as a symbol of the greatness of God. And Shmuel says, well, what's that noise I hear? What are the flocks? Now, of course, Shmuel's a prophet. He knows exactly what's going on. Maybe he wants Saul to be able to be aware that he made a mistake. So he says, what's the sound of the flocks? So Shaul says, oh, and we've taken the best of the animals. I couldn't destroy them. The people wouldn't let me. I was afraid of them, or I was in awe of them, whatever it means. But we offered up the best of sacrifices. And Shmuel says to him, sacrifices? You think God wants your sacrifices? God tells you to destroy something? God says all the gold that you find in the SS lair in Birkenstadt, all the treasures that you find, the gold of the Nazis, don't put it in a bank. Destroy it. It's tainted. It's evil. Can you imagine you find gold that the Nazis took in Auschwitz from gold teeth from concentration camp victims that they melted down? Could you sell that gold? Could you do anything? Could you even give that gold to Tzedakah? Burn it, destroy it, it's evil. So I'm not saying that's you do or you don't do, but I can understand at least. So Saul says, now listen to this, this is unbelievable. So Saul says, the people wanted this. And at the end, what have I done that's so wrong? We wanted to offer up sacrifices to God. At which point Shmuel says to Saul, Lo ashuvimach, I will not come with you to your sacrifices. Ki ma'asta dvar Hashem, you have turned God's word into a disgustingness. V'lo yasaf ot Shmuel ra'ot et Shaul ad yamoto. As long as he lived, Shmuel never saw nor spoke to Saul again. End of story. Shmuel decides this person has to be cut off. You can't have... Now this is Shaul HaMelech. This is a person who was a Navi. I mean, this was Shmuel's student. Shmuel the prophet was Shaul's Rebbe. Can you imagine? Your mentor cut you off. What could Shaul have done that was so terrible? 30 years later, David will see Bathsheba, will conspire to have her husband sent to the front lines, will take her as a wife, will sleep with her. Terrible hate. Not that the prophet will come to him, but David HaMelech is not cut off. That would seem to be to me much worse than offering up sacrifices of Amalek. So what's going on here? Obviously there's a line that you can cross that means that's it. So I'll tell you one possibility. Because what's really going on here, what's missing is, why isn't Shaul, why isn't Lot given the chance to do tshuva? It must be that there's something missing which prevents that. So now listen to this very well. And we'll be done in 3 minutes, and then whatever questions you have. There are three components, three pieces to repentance. Three pieces to tshuva. Okay? There is hakarat achit, right? To recognize the mistake that I make. There is charta, to actually regret it. And then there is kabbalah latid, to decide that I'm going to change my future, I'm not going to do it again. Think about this. You have a business. You have a partner. Or a lawyer in the firm. And he's chasing skirts in the office. He likes to walk by women and pat them in inappropriate places or make comments that are inappropriate. So this is like a terrible thing with sexual harassment. So you take him aside and you sit him down and say, listen, this is inappropriate. You can't do this sort of thing. So he says, what are you talking about? What's a big deal? They love it. Or he says, it's not such a big deal. In other words, what he's doing is, he has no hakarat achet. He doesn't even recognize that he's making a mistake. He certainly has no charata. He doesn't regret it. And therefore, he'll never be able to have kabbalah le'atid to change it. Because if you don't think it's wrong, of course you're not going to change it. In fact, what's really, really wrong about this scenario is that this fellow is doing something wrong, but he actually thinks it's right. If I know I'm doing something wrong and I'm struggling with, can I overcome it? Okay. But if I don't even think I'm doing something wrong, I'll never change it. And I'll tell you something interesting. If I live with someone who does wrong and thinks that it's right, it's only a matter of time before that impacts me. And my own perception of right and wrong becomes very gray. And pretty soon wrong becomes right and right becomes wrong. If you look at any instance in history of a society that turned right into wrong and wrong into right, it began exactly this way. And I wonder if that isn't what's going on here. Why does Rashi take the time to share with us this whole dialogue between the shepherds? Because the issue was not that they were stealing. David HaMelech does a terrible sin. But when he's confronted by the prophet, he says, Chatati Lashem, I have made a mistake. He recognizes his mistake. He has regret for the mistake. And he goes about the very difficult journey of trying to rectify and change who he is. But Saul doesn't recognize that he's made such a serious mistake. He doesn't really regret it. So if you have a king of Israel who's doing something wrong and doesn't even think it's wrong, that undermines the essence of who we are as a people. Because if we're supposed to be an Ohel HaGoyim, if we're supposed to be a light unto the nations, if we're supposed to be a paradigm for what good is, then if good and evil become confused, then what's the point? And that's why Rashi gives me that whole dialogue, maybe. Because the mistake here is not that they're grazing on other people's lands. The mistake is that they're rationalizing it, and they don't even think it's stealing. They're creating a society where right is wrong, and wrong is right. And that has enormous implications. And maybe that's why Avram tells Lot, we need to separate. If what you think is right is really wrong, and what I think is wrong, you think is right, then we can't live together. Because how am I supposed to create a society where people learn what's right if my own nephew is doing what's wrong and think it's right? I have to distance myself from that. This is a very challenging thing. To distance yourself from the experience of the rationalization of evil. And I'll give you just one example to think about. If this is true, if when right becomes wrong, we need to cut ourselves off, I wonder if that isn't only true on an individual level, but it's also true on a national level. Because on a certain level, that's what's going on in Israel today. I'm not talking about which individuals or how many individuals. It's dangerous to generalize. But there is a significant population in the Middle East, and maybe even in the world, that has so glorified evil, that teach their children to emulate suicide bombers, that have so rationalized evil in the name of a cause, which they may deem to be good, and for all I know they're right, although I disagree, that we can't live with that. We have lost an entire generation in the Arab world to peace because an entire generation of children has been brought up to believe that what's wrong is really right. And when you're confronted with that, you can't live with that. By the way, the Allies understood this in World War II. They understood that they were dealing with a society, an axis of evil. That's what they called it. That it sunk into such a level that right became wrong and wrong became right. Turning in a Jew so that he could burn in an oven was good, right? And preaching monotheistic ethics was evil. And society had become so topsy-turvy that there was only one thing to do. It had to be destroyed. And that's why they demanded unconditional surrender. By the way, at the expense of many lives. I wonder if World War II would have been fought today like it was then. Today there'd be a whole rallies and left-wing and whatever. How can you bomb Berlin and how can you destroy Germany and let's make a rapprochement and we'll negotiate with Hirohito? There'd still be a monarchical dictatorship in Japan. So this is very easy to say and it's very hard to do. Sometimes it's with people that you're close with. You know, this is the challenge of addiction. When a person becomes addicted, you know, Rav Tursky, who you may have heard of, once told me that every rabbi has to read the AA handbook. You have to read that book. It's a very powerful book. There's a lot of Judaism in that book and whatever it might be. And one of the things you read in there about addictions, because I've had students with these issues, is that the most difficult stage to arrive at is to recognize truly how really wrong it is. You know? The addict very often rationalizes his addiction and it becomes okay. And you can't live with that. It's one of the most painful experiences to have someone in your home who's an addict, and to know that you can't be a codependent, and you have to remove them from your home, as painful as it might be. And this is our greatest challenge. To know what we can work with and what we can't work with. To know where that line is. To be able to distance ourselves from that gray of good becomes evil and evil becomes good, in order that, God willing, we can create a society that's truly based on the right stuff.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.